Hello, everyone. My name is Joe Rogers, and I'm 49 years old. It's Wednesday, June 12th, 2019, and I'm recording this interview in Statesboro, Georgia. Today, I'm speaking with my grandfather, Ewell Akins. Granddad, do you want to introduce yourself and tell everyone your age?
I'm Ewell Akins. In October, I'll be 99.
Excellent. So, Granddad, last week, we marked the 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion at Normandy, and I thought this would be a great opportunity to talk to you about your experience in the war and find out a little bit about how that may have affected your life. But before we get there, I just wanted to ask you a little bit about your childhood, if that's okay.
That's fine with me.
So, Granddad, where were you born?
Statesboro, Georgia.
So right here where we are right now, how far away from this current house?
Oh, 15 minutes.
And what were your parents' names?
My father was Lewis Hardy Akins. My mother was Bertha Barker. They were married here in Statesboro, Georgia. And all four of us, my three brothers and myself, we were all born in Statesboro.
What did your parents do for a living?
My father was in the trucking business. He hauled produce from Florida to New York and Boston. And later on, he opened up a place in Savannah called Florida Seafood Company. And he hauled produce and fish from Florida up to Savannah.
So when you were a young boy, your dad was on the road quite a bit?
Always going or coming. And I used to drive a truck for him. And I was driving when I was about 12.
Really? So would you say you had a good childhood and that you were close to your parents?
Very good, very good. I gave them a rough time, though, but I was always into something.
Were you?
Yes.
Getting into trouble?
My father would come in the afternoon, and when we would get ready for bed, as soon as he went to bed, I'd go out the back door, push the car out of the garage and down the lane, start it up, and we'd go off somewhere with it, all over town with that car. And I was probably about 15 then, probably. He never knew.
He never knew.
And a couple of times, Doris was in Florida visiting. She'd go to Florida and stay a week with a cousin down there. And her cousin then would come in Savannah, stay a week with them in Savannah. And one night, we went to Florida several times with the car. And the old Ogeechee Road was a bad road, but it was 150 miles roughly. And we'd go with a couple of little boys and myself, and we'd go down and visit them. And one time when we came back, I'd put the car back in. At that time, he had parked it right in the front of the house. And he got up to go to work that morning, and he went out there and got in the car and pulled off, and the front tire blew out right in front of the house. I never bothered that car again. I never bothered that car again after that. I said, man, when we went to Florida, just as fast as that little car drove. It was a little 1937 V8 Ford.
Right.
And as hard as we would go, we'd go down and stay with it a while and come back, put it back.
So how old were you when your parents decided to move to Savannah?
Well, we moved to Savannah several times.
Okay.
Back when I was... hardly remember. We lived in several places in Savannah. We lived on Hall Street, Gwinnett Street, Jefferson Street, just all over Savannah, but mostly out in the area where he built his house. In 1930, he built a house there in Savannah, and it was right across the street from where Doris lived.
So Doris's grandmother. Yep. So Your father built a house, and it was right across the street from where your future wife lived.
That's correct.
How old were you when you first met her?
I was about 10, and Doris was about 8. She's 2 years younger than me. And when we moved in there, I saw some kids over there playing on the street over there on the house. And so I walked over there where they were. And Doris was standing on the railing of the porch. It was about that high, right about my, her feet would be right about almost where my face was. And I walked up there, and a little fat bare feet was there. On the, and I said, "That's my girl."
Oh.
And she always was.
Oh, that's so sweet. So you obviously believed in love at first sight then. And how long were you married?
71 years when she died.
That's great. I know y'all had a wonderful life together.
We always were together. We always worked together. When I was drafted, I went in the Army, and that's when she had to go to work, because that was 1944, and I had the three kids,
mm-hmm.
Lawrence, Carolyn, Brenda, and so she had to go to work because that allowance, I don't think it was about $100 a month, and so she went to work, and of course, we made a pact when we left that she would write to me every day.
Is that right?
Every day she had to write to me. Sometimes be a little short letter or something. But I never got all my mail at one time. We'd get mail sometimes. I wouldn't get mail for a month. And then another time, all of it would come in. I'd have all the letters that I'd keep them, you know, packed together. And she'd write me a little short letter and say she guess she can't think of anything else to write. And sometimes I'd get a nice long letter, and I would write to her the same way, but sometimes I couldn't mail mine all the time. I'd have to write them and like when I got a chance, and I kept them in a, I had a little pack that I carried. And when I'd get a chance somewhere, I'd get them mailed.
Right. So before the war, when you and Grandmother first got married, what were you doing for a living? What was your job?
I was driving a milk truck delivering milk, 3 o'clock in the morning, and put the milk on there. People leave notes on the door, want a pound of butter, they want 2 bottles of milk, whatever, you know. And I'd leave it at the door. Then when it got daylight, then I would go around collecting. Some people had a weekly account, some paid me any time I would come when they left and stuff. But we always had plenty of milk for the kids and all.
Right. Do you recall it being a happy time in your life?
Very nice. Very nice. We were very fortunate. Good times. And my father was still in the trucking business. And Doris had never been to New York. And so one time I took the truck with a load of produce going to New York. And Doris's mother kept the kids, and Doris went with me to New York. And that was the first time she'd ever been to New York.
Did you do all the touristy stuff? Did you see the Statue of Liberty?
No, we rode the subway and right. Statue of Liberty and things like that. But
right.
Not a lot.
Right. You had a job to do,
I
too.
I had a job to do, and we delivered the stuff. And then I had a place I always parked the truck when we'd go to New York. And when we weren't using it, it was a big lot, fenced in, you know. You'd park it down at the foot of the New York and catch the subway up to Manhattan and up to all the
places. Right. So during that time, do you recall being aware of what was going on in Europe? In terms of...
Very much. It was always really? Like it is now. It was on the radio, everybody talking about it. All your friends was being drafted. And,
right.
And everybody had to sign up for the draft. And,
right.
And, of course, when you got your draft card, it had a letter on there and all showed what it was. It was a where you could be expected to go anytime, stuff like that. Sometimes you'd have a 6 month limit on that.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, they'd call you back up to the draft board and they'd take you anyway.
So it could have happened at any time?
Any time.
Yeah. So that was probably.
Always worried about that.
Right. Constantly on your mind.
All your friends, my single friends, most of my friends were single.
Mm-hmm.
I was married and they'd come around the house all the time, but they were, most of them were single, and just about all of them was in the Army before me. It was off, gone.
Yeah. So the America was pulled into the war in 1941 after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and you weren't drafted until 1944, June of 1944, right. Is that right? So do you recall how you found out that you were called up?
Yeah, they said they call you.
They called you on the
phone? Yeah, the draft board is right there in Savannah, and they have a schedule of how many they need, and they tell you right quick. And when you leave, you get, I forgot the number, where it was, an A or whatever, that was me. You can look for them and call you anytime. And if you was an F, I think it was an F, you were unfit for the Army. You were either a drunkard or had problems, medical problems, all kind of stuff like that, a 4F. You wouldn't have to worry about it. But
do you remember the day you got called?
I thought it was the end of the world. I mean, it was horrible. But I couldn't say anything. Everybody was going. My friends was all gone. I was lucky to stay out as long as I did.
Yeah, yeah. When you found out, did grandmother find out at the same time? Did you tell her immediately?
Yes, as soon as the mail came, we knew. I was sent up and told just when to report. And when I knew where I was going, because they'd already gave me a bus ticket to go to Jacksonville to Camp Blanding, which is about 50 miles down the central part of Florida, big farm area. Blanding was, all the training was 100-degree weather. And then when they shipped me up, they told me, they said, you're going overseas. I didn't believe them. I had brothers that had been in the Army for a couple of years, right in the States. I had friends been in the Army right in the States, never been out.
But you knew immediately you had to go.
When my basic training, 17 weeks was over, I got 10 days at home. And I had a ticket to go to Newport News. And then we loaded on the boats there.
Before you left, did you and grandmother talk about the possibility that you might not come back?
We didn't say a word about that. We both knew it. There was
right.
No doubt. We had too many friends that already been
sure.
killed.
Yeah. So after basic training, they sent you to Newport News, you said?
Yeah. I was sent to a replacement camp. They had thousands of soldiers there. Corporals, sergeants, lieutenants, and somebody got killed. They sent a lieutenant from the replacement depot. That was the support.
Mm-hmm.
And I got that about 2 days. I was pulled out and sent to up to the 10th Mountain Division, and because I was a machine gunner, and they were short a machine gunner.
And so from Newport News, they put you on a vessel and you sailed to
about 2 weeks
to Italy.
Sea.
How was that?
Terrible. It was all packed on there. The bunks was 5 high. But I was lucky. A fellow told me, get a top bunk. And when they got, as soon as that ship left, the guys got seasick and vomiting.
You didn't want to be on the bottom.
I was on the top. We were right in the bottom of the ship down there. There was a big square opening in this room where all the bunks were. and that was the engine room. And the old bells and the whistles was banging and ringing, toot all night. And it was all going. Mm. And we could get to go up on the deck 1 hour a day.
Just 1 hour a day. We
rotated them up. They wouldn't let them all go up. It turned ship over.
So everybody on that ship, were they going to the same destination?
We all went to replacement depot.
So when you got to Italy, what was your first impression when you got off the boat?
It was terrible because the little kids was running around eating out. When they'd feed us, we'd go dump our can. We had a tin metal dish, you know, it was in our pack. And they'd set up cookers and fix powdered eggs and all kind of stuff like that. And what we didn't eat, we'd just dump it in the trash can. Kids was there with buckets and all. And they want you to dump it in their buckets. They were eating all that food that we was throwing away. And the kids was there selling the sisters. 10, 12-year-old kids. They were good sister, multi bunny.
Mm. Wow. Did you get a sense that they understood why you were there?
Oh, yeah, they knew why. They when we got assigned to a division further up, Naples and all the was the tips of the boot down there. Mm-hmm. And they were, when we got up above Rome, that's where the line was when I got there, about Rome. And they couldn't get the Germans out of the mountains there. And that's what we were there to do. We were spearhead the Fifth Army and get the Germans out of the mountains. That's what we did.
And can you tell us what your division was? And
it was the 10th Mountain Division, and that was their first action too.
And do you know how many men made up that division?
I said it was probably 20,000.
Wow.
Something like that, 20. I forget just what a division is, but it's around 20,000.
And your objective was to find the Germans that were hiding in the mountains?
No, they were on top of the mountain.
Right.
We climbed the mountain up. We went up at night. And General Hayes said, just keep following the man in front of you. And that's what we did.
And this was the middle of winter, was it?
I don't know. It was the middle
of winter. But it was cold.
Winter, there was snow on the ground. And it was cold. And when there wasn't snow on the ground, there wasn't mud on the ground, almost knee-deep. But on the mountains, it was stone and rock.
So how did you spend your day? What was a typical day like? One, if you were fighting, and two, if you weren't fighting. If you weren't fighting, what was a typical day like?
All of us always there. Sometimes we would get dug in and stop. We'd be there for maybe a day or two. But we were always in a hole or digging a hole. And when we finally got the Germans out of the mountains and on the other side, and we had a hard time keeping up with them. They were running and we were right on top of them. And we chased them 19 days without stopping.
Hmm. Were they running out of supplies?
They were out of supplies. We got their trucks, we got the bicycles from the Italians. It was almost comical. And so they were coming in surrendering, and one man would have 15 prisoners, and we just tell them, go to the back. And the troops coming behind us would pick them up.
But
We had so many we couldn't do them with them. We just motioned them to the back. Mm. They'd come in with their hands up. First thing right. they'd do is take that helmet off. They had a little cloth cap they wore.
So it felt like you were accomplishing your mission.
We knew we were accomplishing. We got all kind of things from the general and everything. And we got awards for action and medals. So,
right. So you said during that time you would occasionally receive some letters from grandmother and you would write her and yeah, mail them when you right. could. Did those help keep you going when you received those?
Boy, everybody was looking for the mail call, man. And when they would bring mail up, some of them would get boxes and packages with cakes and cookies and all broken and smashed up. But it was all good.
So at that time, you had three little girls back home.
That's right.
Yeah. I'm sure you missed them terribly.
Missed them. And every once in a while, in our package of sea rations, we'd get a pack of chewing gum. And I would put the chewing gum, because you couldn't get any at home. Chewing gum, nothing like that. Candy, right. No candy. Send them chewing gum. And I'd get a letter from them, too. Darcy put a letter in there, and they'd just be, you couldn't really read it. It was just scratching.
Right.
But they had written
it. That's sweet.
I still have them.
You do?
Yeah.
Oh. And you used to draw funny little pictures for Grandma on her on the letters, huh?
Yeah.
To try to make her laugh.
Yeah.
So, how long were you in Italy?
I think it's about, I forget the time, I think close to 2 years.
Mm-hmm. So at a certain point, they told you would be able to come home for good or just for a rest and relaxation period or what? Whenever you got to come home, what did they tell you?
I really lucked out. We were the youngest division over there. So they picked us for occupation troops. To stay and control everything.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the division, the other divisions and all, raised so much cane about it that they changed it. Said, okay, they were going to send them to the Pacific. So they changed, kept the other divisions there for occupation troops and redirected us to the Pacific for the Japanese war still going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And so they picked us for occupation, to go to the Pacific. But 10 days delay en route when we get home, Savannah, would be to go home in 10 days while they were getting all the equipment and stuff ready. And so when we landed in Newport News, they dropped the first atomic bomb.
Mm.
And when I got home, for the 10 days at home, they dropped the second one. And the war ended while I was home. So I still had to report back to Colorado for the headquarters. So I reported back to Colorado. And I'd already sent a wire to the first sergeant there in Colorado asking for another 10 days delay of being the war was over. And they denied it and said, report back. So when I reported back to Colorado, the old sergeant said, what are you doing here? I said, you wouldn't give me a pass. He said, yeah, you got it. I turned around and went back home for 10 more days. And while I was home, is when the war really ended.
Right.
And when the war ended, I went back to Colorado and got examined and all that stuff and got discharged. And so I had friends that I'd met over there that was doing all the cane raising. When we got the ship for the Pacific, they was 2 or 3 years getting back. They worked at the plant where I worked. And they were, a couple of years because they were still at occupation troops mm-hmm. before they got home.
Wow. So you did get lucky.
I lucked out on it.
Yeah.
I was in Newport News on the ship unloading when they dropped the first bomb.
Wow, that's incredible. So I'm sure it was a relief.
It was, boy. We knew it. That was going to do it.
Yeah, yeah. And there was...
If they hadn't have done it, they'd already estimated, I forget how many million soldiers would have been killed trying to go into Japan. Because they would fight to the end.
Right.
And they already been losing thousands and thousands on these beachheads. And to go into Japan, it was going to be in the millions. And so it was well lucky that Truman okayed it up in the bomb.
Right. And you received several medals for your service. Yeah. Can you tell me about those?
Well, I got the Bronze Star mainly because we went up, we were attacked in the Germans on the top of the mountain up there. And we got up there and said, the ammo bearers didn't follow. Here we are sitting up there with a machine gun with no ammo.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked the sergeant, I said, you want me to go get them? He said, you know where? I said, yeah, I know where they are. He said, go get them. And so I took off down, and I had to go through the artillery and everything else, getting back down to where they were. They were in a shell hole. There was a big shell hole there when they crossed the Po River. And they were in that shell hole because when I left, I told them, they're supposed to follow me. They didn't follow me. And I got back there, and they were all, stay down, get out. And with the artillery was still pretty bad. I said, I'm going back, and you better be back behind me, because if you don't, you're going to get go to the court-martial.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be court-martialed. And so I took off. I didn't even look back. When I got back up there, they were right behind me. So this sergeant turned me in for the Bronze Star or a decoration. I don't know how it works, but anyway, the General Hayes is the one that issued it.
What else did you receive?
Well, it was just the usual for each one of the combats. You know, a little oak leaf cluster mm-hmm. on your badge and on the... I'll have to show you, but those little the different battles that we win.
Right, right. So, once you were discharged, how was it getting back into civilian life?
Easy.
I can imagine.
And I got back home. I called my boss. I said, we got to come back to work. He said, anytime you want to. I said, I'll be there tomorrow.
No, you didn't take any additional time.
No, I went back to work the next day. Never mentioned the war. I never had anybody else to mention it. Nobody said, well, was it rough? What happened? Nobody until probably 20 or 30 years.
Really?
Before anybody ever said anything about it. And all of a sudden, everybody started... thinking and things like that. But,
right.
But not one word. Well, I was already retired before I ever heard anybody ever mention it. Nobody ever knew I was in the Army, I think.
Did that bother you?
No, it just bothered me. I wasn't looking for it. In fact, I hadn't even thought about it, but all this thinking and stuff like that came along later.
Mm-hmm.
I was surprised.
Yeah.
Because it's been so long, nobody'd ever even mentioned it.
Right, right. So, what was your job after? What did you go back to?
I went back to the same job. Mm-hmm. I was in warehousing and stores, and I went back to the same job. In fact, the jobs were held for you. That was the law. When you went in the Army, your job was the companies would hold it. They could buy, hire temporary people.
Right.
But they knew that when the soldiers come back, they were going to get the job.
So, at that point, how long did you stay at that job? And was the one right after that at Union Camp, or was there a job in between? Or?
No, that was my job. When I got that job at Union Camp, I found a home. And I started working there in 1941. And when I was drafted, I knew that I did change for a job one time. They had a shipyard right in Savannah, you know, right? Mm-hmm. Two of them. And I said, well, they were paying $1 an hour. That was the cheapest rate, I mean, $1 an hour. And I was making 76 cents an hour at Union Camp. So I went out there and they hired me and I went to work at the shipyard.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked there, I don't know, maybe a couple of months or something. And that was good money and all of it. And I got thinking about it and I told Doris, I said, you know, when this war is ending, the shipyard is going to close and I won't have a job and I don't want to be without a job.
Mm-hmm.
So I called my boss out at the Union Camp and asked him, could I come back to work? He said, I'll be glad to have you. I told him at the shipyard there that I said, I'm quitting. He said, you can't quit. I said, what do you mean I can't quit? He said, if you quit, they're going to draft you. They have to turn them in. And that's, I guess I worked probably about 6 months before I was drafted.
Mm.
But they drafted me.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Union Camp had an industrial flag, whatever you call it, for the being a war plant. And that's why I'd get a 6 month deferment every time I'd have to come up for the draft.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the same thing at the shipyard, but I didn't know you couldn't quit.
Right.
And they said, if you quit, they got to turn your name in. Mm. I said, well, they'll just have to. But after I was back about 6 months, I guess, before I was drafted.
Right. But you stayed there until you retired.
I stayed there. Not only did I stay there, I got Doris for a job out there, and Doris went out to work out there. We went to work every day together, drove together, came home together.
Right.
If she had to work I stayed over. I could stay at any time. And when I retired in 1985, I was 65 years old. And I already told them, when I'm 65, I'm retired. And I retired in 1985, and I was 65. And Doris is going to work a couple more years because she was 2 years younger than me. Mm-hmm. She wasn't really old enough. She could take She didn't finish the month. She came home one day and said, I'm retiring too. I'm going to take early retirement. I'm not going to work. You lay up in bed.
So it was time to
she retired in
reap the benefits of all your hard work.
That's right. So that's
So when y'all were working, y'all went back to school too?
Yeah. All the time we were out in Alabama. I went, Doris didn't go. I was going to night school and I was just about finished getting my diploma and all. And she said, I think I'll go too. And darn it, she didn't just about graduate before I did. She was one of the A students.
Right.
When the kids made anything below an A, they were, she was on top of them. A B wasn't good enough for them.
Was it important for y'all to go back and get your college diploma, or is it?
I guess so. Doris got an accounting degree, and I don't really know where mine was. I was an assistant storekeeper, and when I went to Alabama, I went out to a new plant as storekeeper, and while I was there, I got promoted to purchasing agent, and I was a purchasing agent for the plant, and I didn't. They might have helped. They paid for all of it. No, there wasn't any GI Bill or anything. Mm-hmm. I had to, as long as you got a passing grade in the courses you were taking, the company would pay for it. Mm-hmm. And they put it in part. They'd refund me. And the union camp paid for all of my school. In fact, paid for all of Darce's. And Darce's was the first office worker to be promoted as a supervisor.
She did a great job.
Yeah, she was a supervisor of the purchasing and, not purchasing, accounting and payroll. Mm-hmm. She had both those apartments.
You also, during that time, got your pilot's license?
Yes, I did. I forgot about that. Yeah. I had already told Darce, when we go to Alabama, the first thing I'm going to do is learn how to fly. I always wanted to. Mm-hmm. That's what I did. And she said, well, first thing I'm going to do, I'm going to get a big TV. Which we did. We got one of the biggest TVs they had at that time.
So you never slowed down, though. You just, you would always find something new and interesting to do to keep you occupied and keep your mind going.
We built a house in Gatlinburg.
Yeah.
And every Friday night we'd get off, it'd take us 8 hours, we'd drive up there. And we had a contractor up there building it. We'd go up there and it looked like nothing was done. We'd go up there and paint and work on certain things. And finally got it built. It took about a year.
Yeah. Spent many happy times there. Yeah. Do you feel like you accomplished most of what you wanted to accomplish in life?
I think so. I still do my genealogy. I mm-hmm. got interested in that. And I got over 17,000 names in this computer of relatives.
Well, before we get to the end of the interview, I just wanted to take a minute, if I could, just to share some of my thoughts and reflections on you.
Good.
So one of the things that I've always admired about you is that it seems like you never let your circumstances define your life. You kept always pushing forward. And you kind of created your own path, and for as long as I've known you, you've always seemed like you've lived your life with a certain amount of joy and passion and compassion for others, love for your family, and, you know, there's a certain curiosity that you have, too, that I think drives you. Do you think that would be an accurate description of?
Yeah, we were very fortunate, and I had a good partner.
You did.
And
yeah. Have you always been a positive person, or is that something you had to learn?
I always knew that you had to work for it, what you wanted.
Right.
You know, nobody's going to give you anything.
Right. So you would make it happen if you wanted it.
That's right.
Yeah.
We had a strange thing that happened that in Savannah, where Darce lived, you know, was right across the street.
Mm-hmm.
And she never lived anywhere else. She was born down at the old Telfair Hospital in Savannah, which was Women's Hospital. She'd always lived at that house on across the street there. And back in, I guess, about 2013 or something like that, I don't remember the exact date, my oldest brother was visiting us out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sitting there looking at the pictures and things in the book and all. And he says, do you remember when we lived in that house? I said, no, what are you talking about? That we used to live in that house there. I never heard of such a thing. Darson had always lived there, the Lewises and all. And I said, well, after he left and all, I said, I think he must be mistaken. Something I can't believe. I don't know. I don't remember ever living.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Doris and I went to town in Savannah and looked up and found the city directory for 1923. There it was. Lewis Hardy Aikens family listed 601 West 42nd Street. And we lived there. Nobody ever mentioned it. None of the Johnsons and all of
right.
Doris didn't know it.
Right.
And that was in the date and all where they lived there was 1923. Doris was not born
right.
at that time we lived there.
Right.
But she was born right after that in some way. But we had lived in that house. We had lived in the corner house across the street over there. And we had lived in the block back of that house on 42nd Street twice. One time on the south side of the street, one time in the house on the north side of the street. And I remember that because I remember living there. I remember mm-hmm. going to school from there. And it was just amazing.
Great, an amazing coincidence.
Yeah.
I mean, your families were...
Especially that nobody ever mentioned it.
Right.
Surely it looked like somebody would have said something about it.
So we're getting toward the end here. Is there anything else about you that you'd want people listening to this to know about you?
Well, I was born behind, you know what the old Jekyll Hotel is?
Nope.
That little hotel downtown on the west side, West Main Street.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little hotel there. And back of it on Vine Street, it was a little bungalow. And I was born there. And all four of us boys was born in Statesboro.
Yeah.
But my father moved back into, he must have liked Savannah. But he was always, I think what I figured out was every time my mother got pregnant, he'd move back to Statesboro.
Right.
Because his mother and father lived
right.
over South Main Street.
Right.
And they could look after her. Because he yeah. was never home. He was all on the road going.
Right. Right. Well, Granddad, I know I speak for your children and for your family. When I say that we appreciate your service to your country, we know you made sacrifices, and we appreciate all those as well. On a personal level, I appreciate the example that you set. You certainly give us all something to look up to, someone to look up to.
Appreciate that.
And we appreciate that, and we love you very much.
Well, I think I got a good family. All the children, all been not the problems that other families seem to have.
We've been very lucky.
Very, very lucky.
Very, very fortunate. Well, thank you, Granddad.
All right, we captured it.
You did?
We did. We got it. They gave us...